Well, everybody, my name is Greg, and I'm an alcoholic. My sobriety date is February the 19th, 2005. And I've been in Charlottesville for about 10 years, but I'm originally from Alabama, so occasionally you'll hear some stuff come out of me that you'll get it. I was trying to think of, you know, when they say when you talk, you're supposed to try to, you know, tell a joke or something funny. And I just was thinking, I was just telling a friend of mine, I'm like, as soon as this, if this gets on the website, I'm gonna burn a copy of it. I'm gonna take it to a friend of mine. I'm gonna say, you have got to hear this speaker, so that he can, you know, and then he'll hear it's me, and he'll be like, ah, I get it. So anyway, I appreciate being asked to speak. I think it's important to give back. Somebody was there for me, and I got up here, heard a lot of speakers in my 6 years, and I'm just really glad to be here. So thanks for inviting me. My story is probably not that different from a lot of people. I think that at some point in life, alcohol became a solution for me, and I don't really know where that was. I come from a long line of alcoholics. My grandfather, my father's died alcoholic without ever knowing any real sobriety. I ended up going to his funeral this past February, and it was an experience. And but when I was younger, I always felt like I didn't fit in, and I don't know if you've ever heard that before, but I didn't feel like I fit in at all. And what was worse is that when I was with my family, I knew I didn't belong with them, you know. But when I was out in public with other people, I couldn't fit in with them. I was too good for my family, but I wasn't good enough for everybody else. And so I was in this quandary. I mean, even at a young age, I was going into, you know, I would try to seek, you know, going into church to try to get away from, you know, the craziness at home. And then on the weekends, you know, before that, I would be out doing whatever. But, you know, alcohol became a solution. And, you know, there were things that I can go back to, and I can remember that were incidences where alcohol worked for me. You know, I can remember when I knew that I was riding around town. It was a very small town in Alabama. It's called Carbon Hill, little coal mining town. Yes, they have coal mines in Alabama. My mom was a coal miner's daughter. And so in this area, it was illegal to have, it was illegal to buy beer. So you had what they called a bootlegger, and, you know, the bootlegger usually lived in a trailer with a circular drive, and, you know, people would drive around to the back, and then they would drive back out the other side. And, you know, so it was illegal for anybody to, you know, to sell it. And so it was very easy to get beer when I was young, because it was illegal anyway, so they didn't care whether they were selling it to you, an adult, or me, a teenager. So it was real easy to get alcohol, and I can just remember this time when I knew that I was, you know, I wasn't fitting in with this hometown crowd, because I'd spent the first 15 years of my life growing up in Birmingham, Alabama, you know, big city. And, you know, so I come into this small town, and of course I'm better than everybody there, but I'm not good enough. And, you know, I can remember, you know, using alcohol as a way to try to fit in. You know, with some, at least with alcohol, I could fit in with some people, because there were other people that, you know, were drinking and were just doing all these crazy things. But I can remember this specific night when I knew that somebody I was going to get into a fight with, and I had those butterflies in my stomach, you know, the ones, you know, that are there, and I didn't know what to do about it. And, you know, I'm not a very big guy, and I wasn't very big back then either. A little smaller, actually. And, you know, I went to the bootlegger, and I got a little pint of whiskey, and I started sipping on it. And I sipped on it and sipped on it until those butterflies kind of went away, and it was replaced with that buzzy feeling that you get with, you know, drinking straight liquor and just, you know. And I did. I got into a fight with this guy, and he couldn't show his face in town for, you know, for about a week, because I'd beat him so bad that he, you know, he couldn't show his face. And, you know, that's just one of those times when alcohol really worked for me. My dad, an alcoholic, and he was the kind of alcoholic, when he would drink, he didn't necessarily, it wasn't always immediately bad, you know, but he would start with beer, and he would increase the amount of beer, and this would happen over a period of like 6 weeks. You know, he would get, you know, from beer to, as soon as he hit the whiskey, the hard liquor, it was over. You know, it was just a matter of time before he was, you know, detoxing somewhere in a nursing home or whatever. And I never drank like that. You know, I was like, I am not an alcoholic because I don't drink like my dad. You know, I'm not an alcoholic because my dad is an alcoholic and I'm not like my dad. And if you think I didn't fit in there, I really didn't want to fit in with that. So I spent a lot of time, growing up and just using alcohol as a solution for anything. If I didn't feel like I fit in anywhere, I drank. And I would go through periods where I would try to stop. And, you know, earlier when I was in, like, I got to go to college, and while I was in college, there was a period where I actually stopped drinking. And it wasn't because I had some, you know, great good reason for it, you know, and I don't even really know why, you know, but I know I stopped drinking, and it didn't last for that long, because eventually I had to leave school. I didn't leave school because they asked me to, but after a certain number of years of partying and running out of money, you know, eventually you're going to have to go. And so from the fact that I had moved from Birmingham to this small town, and when I left the small town and went to college, and then from college I went into the military, and, you know, I had a whole new outlook. You know, I had great things happening with me. I was a nuclear mechanic in the Navy. Woohoo! You know, I was real smart. That was the other thing. I thought I was really smart. I test really well. You know, but a lot of that is just because I can test well. It's not because I'm actually really smart. So I was in the military, and I got married. I got divorced. I got out of the military. There was nothing really spectacular about that, other than the fact that, you know, I was still not fitting in, you know. But one of the things that the military taught me was that after a couple of years, I could move and I could start over with a new bunch of new people, and so then I started the geographical cure, you know. And from that point, when I was in the military, I moved to, I was in Orlando and went to Charleston, South Carolina. I went to Newport News, Virginia, and Virginia Beach, and Portsmouth. And when I finally got out of the military, I went back to Atlanta, where my sister lived. And I don't even want to talk about the damage that I did there. It was just not a good thing. And eventually, I went back to Alabama. I went back to college. And I finished my degree because something about being in the military, when they almost hold a gun to you and say, you're going to study, you actually learned how to study, and I was able to go back to school and finish a degree. But as soon as I was done, I got a job working with a company right in Jacksonville, Alabama, which is where I went to college, Jacksonville State University. And I would go to work, I would work, and then I would go home, and I would sit at my kitchen table, and I would drink beer, and I would just be on the computer, and this was just all I did, you know. And eventually the town got really boring, and what happened really was is that, you know, at work things weren't going quite the way they should be, and, you know, my family, I wasn't really getting along with them in Alabama, and I just needed to go. So I went back to Virginia Beach, and, you know, even there, the same thing, you know, just wasn't fitting in. My drinking was getting in the way of my jobs. I joke about the fact that, you know, I was one of the, me and another friend of mine were one of the first two people that got laid off from a company that had grown too quickly. And we always said, well, you know, it was great that we got let go first, because then we didn't have to worry about, you know, when the axe was going to come. And I think the real reason we got let go is because we were alcoholics. You know, and we were drunk, you know, and we would go to work drunk, and you could smell alcohol on us, and it just was, that's just how it was. I mean, you know, I look back at, and I tell people all the time, well, I never lost a job because of drinking, you know, but the truth is I lost probably a lot of jobs because of drinking, because if I wasn't asked to leave, then the work got in the way of the drinking, or got in my head. You know, I don't know if anybody's ever felt like, you know, people at work were going to find out that you really shouldn't be working there. You know, and that's the way I feel today. Sometimes, I get it in my head that I'm not supposed to be here. I'm not good enough for this job. But even back then, when thinking about the jobs that I had and the jobs that I lost, you know, alcohol was always there. You know, it was always there. And I went through this period where I got my car repossessed because I couldn't pay the car payment. And it wasn't because I didn't have the money. It was because I was using it for something else. There were times when, you know, most of my bills were late. There were times when I didn't pay my car insurance or I didn't get my registration on my car or I didn't pay my car payment. You know, and these were all things I thought I could let slide. And it was insanity. It just was really stupid to think about like that. But I know people do that, you know, because I meet people all the time that, I didn't pay my rent. I didn't pay this. But I always had money for alcohol. That's just the thing. And I was not one of those that would, I didn't want to be my dad, so I didn't want to sit at the kitchen table and drink beer. So I tried to be more social about it. You know, I spent a lot of time out I have no idea why I didn't get a DUI. I don't know why I didn't have a car accident or kill anybody. But I would go through these periods where I would do all this controlled drinking, you know, where I would tell myself, you know what, I can't go to this bar because when I do, I get drunk. So I have to go to a different bar. I can't hang out with this person because when I'm with them, I get so drunk, I can't see straight, you know, and so I'd make all these little, you know, try these things that I would try to control my drinking. And I spent a lot of time trying to control my drinking. And so I hear people, you know, talk about relapsing and stuff. And I think when I came in here, I had already tried all of the control. You know, when I came in, I didn't have any questions about it anymore, you know. So eventually, like I said, I was in Norfolk, Virginia. And I had got my car repossessed and I had destroyed a couple of friendships and was living in one place. And my hobby was photography, and so I got a job working in a photo lab. And after about 6 months, they decided to make me manager of a store. And so I went to Colonial Heights, Virginia, and was there for about 6 months. And it was the same thing. I would work and I would drink and work and drink. And after about 6 months of that, I was asked to go to Charlottesville, Virginia to manage a store. And this is kind of where my story changes a little bit, because once I moved into Charlottesville, the day I drove into Charlottesville, I knew that Charlottesville is where I wanted to live. I don't know what it was about it, but I knew that I didn't want to be anywhere else. And so I began making decisions based on that. You know, the place that I lived, I rented a room when I first got there. It was a very nice room. It was the master bedroom in this three-story house, and it was awesome. I mean, I had windows all the way around the room, and I could see out, and there was a nice pond with a willow tree. And, you know, I was creating this little, you know, this little paradise, and yet I was still doing the same things. I was still drinking. I was still, wreaking havoc. I would hang out with people, and I would try to control my drinking. You know, and about this time I started dumbing down my jobs and I started moving around. I moved down to downtown Charlottesville, where I lived, every morning I'd walk down across the downtown mall and up to where I worked, which was in a mortgage place. And when I got off of work around, I don't know, 3 in the afternoon or 4, or just depends on what it was, there was a bar right down below it called South Street. So I would get out of work, and I would go straight down there, and that's where I'd have my first drink, and maybe my second or third, and I would just continue on. I would hit, you know, sometimes I would hit Rapture, sometimes I would hit, if I was feeling better than everybody else, I'd go to Blue Light, I spent a lot of time drinking, and it was easy, because when I got tired, I could just walk home, and it was easy. And But eventually, I couldn't even hold that job. And, you know, again, I started dumbing down my jobs a little bit. And eventually, I was working as a helper, as an electrician. And, I mean, I have a college degree. I have a huge amount of military background. And I have a lot of skills. And I was a helper. And there's nothing wrong with that. But for me, there's just... On the outside, I shouldn't have been there. And I had gotten married again and was still doing the whole alcohol thing. I still felt like I needed to not drink at home alone, so I would drink in bars. And the last place that I drank was a little place called Fat Daddy's. That was a real classy joint. And I went there a lot. And so while I was there, and, you know, over the... I mean, I really was full of myself. I really thought... I mean, it's just so funny. I mean, I know that people talk about it, but, you know, we're like the greatest gift to, you know, to the earth. You know, if we could just, you know, it says in the book, if we could just get our arms around from the, you know, from around the toilet. Or not in the book. You know, but it's just... So I really thought I had so much promise, you know. There were a couple of experiences even before that where, you know, I would drink, I would get horribly drunk, you know, I would do this, you know, projectile vomiting thing, you know, and, you know, just create all this havoc, and then I would try to control my drinking for a little while, and then I was done, you know. And then I would drink one, then I'd drink two, then they'd come back, and I couldn't figure out what was going on. And finally, there was the night. What really happened was I went out to Fat Daddy's, and I was going to have a beer, and I was going to have a B&B because, you know, brandy and Benedictine, that's what, you know, the fancy people drink. And so I was going to have one of those, and I didn't have one. I don't know what the final count was. But when I woke up the next morning, I don't remember driving. I don't remember getting in my car. I do remember driving, actually, a little bit. I remember there being somebody in my car. I have no idea who it was. I don't know where I took them. I have no recollection of it. I don't remember getting home or getting in bed. None of that stuff. I mean, it was a total blackout, and it scared me. It scared me pretty bad. And the worst part was when I woke up the next morning, I couldn't move. I mean, it was like every part of my body ached. And, you know, I wish I could explain the feeling of just feeling like your body, it was like, I've had enough. And I walked into the bathroom, and I looked in the mirror, and I finally saw the person that I never wanted to become, and I saw my dad. And I realized that I was about his age when I was his age about the time I was in high school when I could see his life just totally falling apart. And I was like, you know what, I have to stop. I have to do something. And a friend of mine had told me about a little bit about AA. He told me that, you know, you got chips, you know, and that you made amends to people and things like that. And I'm like, well, I like the idea of the chip, you know. So I said, I thought about it, and I decided I wasn't going to go that just right then. And I went to a bar. And I sat down, and I wasn't going to drink. And I had like a Coke, and then I had a glass of tea, and I'm not kidding you, I had coffee, I had hot chocolate. I had just about anything that they would offer just to try to feel something, feel comfortable. And I couldn't, and nothing worked. And I was like, okay, well, I'll go to AA, and I'll get the chip. That's what I'll do. And, so I went to an AA meeting, and this is typical of my attitude. I walked in and I looked around and I was like, these people are losers. You know, I don't have anything in common with you. I don't want what you have. Oh my God, you look homeless. You know, and there, I sat next to somebody who smelled like an ashtray. And I didn't smoke, and I didn't want to be there. And I didn't hear a word anybody said. I didn't hear a single word. From the moment I walked in, I identified out. And at the end of the meeting, the woman said, "Well, we don't have chips at this meeting." And I was like, "You don't have chips?" And I was like, "You've got to be kidding me." So immediately I left, and I drove across town to another meeting. It's funny because now that I know the meeting, you know, it's like a halfway house, and they weren't going to let me in there just to get a white chip. So I had to go to another meeting. And when I went to this meeting, I walked. That was on a Sunday, and on a Monday, as soon as I got off of work, 5 o'clock, at 5:30, I was in an AA meeting. And as I'm walking up, again, I'm just there for a white chip. And this person walks up, and, you know, and he's kind of dressed really nice, and, you know, and he looks like he's got it all together. And I'm like, well, he obviously isn't going to an AA meeting. And it turns out he was. You know, he's like, "Are you here to go to an AA meeting?" And I said, "I am." And he started talking to me, and I was like, "Well, this guy seems normal." And I know that's I was still, you know, that's what I was doing. I was judging everybody, and it's very easy to do. It's very easy to do for me. And so I ended up walking in and sitting down, and I picked up a chip. And there were a couple of meetings I went to when some, you know, they would go around and introduce yourself, and I would say, you know, "My name's Greg, and I think I might be an alcoholic," as if I needed any more proof. And so I sat around and I listened, and I started relating, and I was like, "Wow, this is really I feel really comfortable here." And I think about that sometimes when I'm in a meeting, and I think, gosh, I hope there's nobody here that you know, can't relate, you know, that to something that somebody says, you know, or comes in with such a prejudice that they can't hear, you know, that there are people here that have been in pain and they're getting out from under it. And I started listening, and I heard the suggestions, you know, to go to 90 meetings in 90 days. To get a sponsor and work the steps. And, you know, I'd look up at the steps and I'd see that one that says God, and I would be like, you know, I'll just stick around for a while. You know, if I'm an alcoholic and I was pretty sure I was, then I probably owed it to myself to learn as much as I could about AA, or learn about, at least about alcoholism. You know, if I wasn't going to stick around in AA, at least I could learn about what was going on. And so I did. I got a sponsor. Got a sponsor, and I made meetings a part of my work week. And I didn't do, I'm pretty sure I didn't do 90 and 90, but, you know, on Monday, Thursday and Friday at 5:30, I was in a meeting. And on Tuesdays at 7:30, I was in a meeting. I probably went to one or two meetings on a Saturday and one or two on a Sunday. So I may or may not have done 90, but what I did was I got a lot of Big Book. I got a lot of, you know, hearing people share their stories, and I just really could relate. And I didn't come in here because for any reason other than just the fact that I wanted to quit drinking. And I'm going to read this part out of Big Book. It's a little out of context, but I think that, you know, if you're anything like me, you can relate. And it's on page 52, and it says, you know, "We were having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy, and we couldn't seem to be of real help to other people." And let me tell you, that was me. You know, and I didn't, when you're, you know, the whole alcohol fog, when you're in it, you can't see it, you know. And I couldn't see that I was having all these problems. I just couldn't see it. And, you know, so my sponsor, great, great guy, suggested that we work the steps. And I was like, okay, well, I'll do that. And so and I have to tell you also that the first person that I asked to be my sponsor never showed up. And, you know, I actually went to his place and he wasn't there. And so after a couple of times, I left, you know, and I told him, I was like, well, obviously it's not going to work out. So I went and asked his sponsor to be my sponsor. And, when I started working the steps, and I didn't put a whole lot of effort into it. I didn't think a lot about it, and you know, the big thing I kept hearing was this four-step inventory, and I wasn't really thinking about one, two, or three. I mean, I read them, and you know, so I got to step four, and you know, I was listing resentments, and one of the big resentments was my brother. And my brother, I didn't mention my family, but I have two brothers and two sisters, and you know, my family split early when I was young. But my brother, who was a year older than me, I always felt like he was my father's favorite, and he could get away with just about anything. And my mom had made the mistake of telling me one time that when I was going from the first grade into the second grade, they wanted to put me from the first grade into the third grade. But they didn't do it because my brother was going from the second grade to the third grade, and they didn't want it to mess him up. I was pissed. I mean, I really was. I mean, I was pretty ticked off. So this is on my resentment inventory. I'm resentful at him because, you know, this is why I am not a success in life. You know, he is the cause of all of my troubles. And so my sponsor, and I'm telling him this, and I'm telling him everything he did, and he goes, "Well, what did your brother do?" I'm like, "Well, what do you mean?" And he says, "Well, what did he do?" I'm like, "Well, he didn't really do anything." And he says, "Well, how much time do you think your brother spends thinking about this?" I'm like, "Well, probably not enough. remind me to tell him." And you know, and at some point you have to go back and you have to look at the, you know, my life was unmanageable. You know, that the thing I read, my life is unmanageable. And so if you start back with the first step, which is what I had to do, I had to start back with the first step, and you know, I am an alcoholic and my life is unmanageable. And eventually, you know, when I got to step two, I knew that there was a power greater than myself, and I didn't know what it was, but I was willing to believe that there is something, and yes, if I think that I can put some faith in God and I can turn my life over and stop trying to run it and stop trying to manipulate it. And a lot of that for me was so much, wasn't necessarily, you know, putting an exact finger on God, but just a lot of it was recognizing that I'm not God. And that I have to get my hands off of it. I have to get my hands off of trying to manipulate people, you know, trying to make people fit my mold, or, you know, I had to stop playing God. And once I was able to do that, you know, the fourth step really meant a lot more to me, you know, because I was able to actually look at it from a perspective of, well, what was my part? You know, I found out that I'm fearful. You know, I'm pretty much just about afraid of everything. And I'm selfish, and I think way more of myself than I should. And so I have a lot of these things, but you know, without doing an inventory, I didn't know this. Without doing an inventory, I didn't know that the reason that I was pissed at you wasn't because of something you did, but it was because of me not feeling good enough about myself, or me being too selfish with things and holding you accountable for stuff that you know you're not accountable for. But if I hadn't done the fourth step, I wouldn't know these things. And I didn't know them just by doing the fourth step, because I had to have my sponsor say, that's not exactly what that means. You know, it's not their fault. You know, what is your part in this? And that's where I would find the things like the fear and the selfishness. And, you know, it's all right here in the book. And so after meeting with my sponsor, and I didn't think I really got the grasp of what step six was really about. You know, the first time I, you know, went through step six and seven, but in the 12 and 12, you know, it says that, you know, this is the step that separates the men from the boys from the men. And I finally got it one day that it means going from boy to man. It means going from, it basically means growing up, you know, and start taking responsibility for my recovery. You know, I have all this information about, you know, being afraid of everything, all these relationships that I have, you know, put my fingers on. And I had all this information, and I realized that, you know what, I don't want to be the person that I've always been. I need, and I know that I have to do something about it. And so, you know, I prayed the seventh step prayer, and I made an effort, you know, to say, God, I don't want to be this person. You know, show me the kind of person that you want me to be. And then everything was great after that. I'm just kidding. Because, you know, at that point, I really had, you know, I still had the steps 8 and 9, you know, and in part of learning about, you know, myself through those earlier steps, I had to, some of the amends that I made were a little bit different. This is hysterical. I had been driving without a license, and I had the state of Virginia telling me that, you know, that I owed them $500 or $600 because I was driving without a license. I was like, you got to be kidding me. And this part of this happened before, and so I was granted this hearing of some sort, and it was a phone hearing, and I was talking to my sponsor and to other people about it, and I'm like, you know, I've got to have this hearing. And so the day I have this phone hearing, I get on the phone and I dial it up, and I'm waiting, and the person answers the phone, and I'm like, you know, I'm calling because I have to, you know, have this hearing with you on the phone. And he said, you're too early, call me back in 10 minutes. And he hung up on me. And I was like, oh, this is awesome. And so, you know, I'm sitting there and I'm just shaking. And by the way, I had my checkbook out. And I was ready to write the check for the $600. And the guy came on the phone and I said, well, before we go any farther, I just need to say that, you know, I'm an alcoholic, and I know this is me on the phone telling somebody I'm an alcoholic, and I have to be honest, and I have to tell the truth. And the truth is that I know I was driving without, you know, without insurance, and so I know that I need to pay the fine. So if you'll just tell me how much I need to write the check, you know, I'll do that. And he said, well, I have to ask you some questions first. And I was like, okay. So he asked me some questions about where I was living and, you know, what I was doing at the time, and, you know, did I get this letter? And, you know, I have no idea what I got. And I was honest, you know, and I told him, you know, I'm not sure about, you know, some of this stuff, but this is where I'm at. And he said, well, and I'm like waiting for him to tell me where to send the check to. And he says, well, we'll send you a letter. And then he, you know, got off the phone, and I was like, well, now what do I do? I have this money set aside, so I'll just hold on to it. And I think I cried when I picked up the letter because it said there was enough evidence to find that, you know, you may not have been at fault, you know, for having driven, you know, you might not have gotten a notification, and so, you know, we're not going to hold you to this. I'm like, I was done. I mean, I was ready to do that, and that was just one of those simple things that, you know, that helped. That was one of those, you know, conditioning moments. You know, like the alcohol was the thing that helped me get through the fight. You know, this was one of those things that made me even more ready to be able to make amends to people. And so one of the amends I had to make was with an employer. I used to work as in a camera store as a manager, and when I sat down, I was joking with him. I said, I may or may not have stole something from the store that was about $160. And he just kind of cracked up laughing, and I came clean. I said, "Well, I stole a lens." I said, "But there's more." I said, "I'm smart enough to know how to manipulate things in the computer, and I made it look like if the camera lens was found to be stolen, that you would blame somebody else because I used a Nikon camera and this person used a Canon camera." And I made it look like a Canon lens had been stolen. And so I told him, I said, I need to make sure that you understand my motives because I need to understand my motives because I don't want to be that person anymore. And I don't want to be the one that does that. And, you know, so I had to go and actually, you know, tell him this, and I had to look him in the eye and tell me, when you do stuff like that, it really changes you. It really changes you. It makes you not want to be that same person. And so I think it's real important to understand what our motives are in doing amends and or why we're having to make amends. And then, you know, the other thing that I'm really grateful for my sponsor is that I can call him up on the phone and I can tell him, well, you know, this is what's going on and I really don't understand what my part is in it. And he'll say, well, you know, You continue to watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear. And when they crop up, we ask God at once to remove them. Discuss it with another alcoholic. Make amends quickly if we've harmed anyone. Turn our thoughts towards helping someone else. Love and tolerance is our code. And I don't know that because I sat on the book and I memorized it. I know that because I asked him so many times what my part was that he read it to me. You know, he knew it from memory, and so now I know it from memory. And I, you know, when I talk to people that I work with in Alcoholics Anonymous, I tell them all the time: continue to watch out for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, fear, because it doesn't say if they crop up; it says when they crop up. You know, so the other important part about this is that if I hadn't done a thorough fourth step, I wouldn't even know how to do a tenth step. Because if I don't know how to look, you know, how to look at what my part is in resentments and those types of things, I don't know what my part is, and I don't know how to get to it, and I don't know how to get any relief from it. And if I've never done a four step, I think alcohol would still be a solution for me instead of working a tenth step. And you know, the 11th step prayer and meditation. I wish I could say that, you know, I was this great meditator, and, you know, I'm not. And a lot of my prayers sometimes are, you know, God help me. You know, and sometimes I pray when I'm in the shower or when I'm driving, or, you know, I pray at different times. But I still understand that I'm not God, and I'm okay with that. You know, I'm reminded that I'm not God on a daily basis. Someone either kicks me in the butt or I get embarrassed about something that I did that wasn't smart. And, you know, so I have these things that remind me that I'm not God. And, you know, step 12, for me, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. My sponsor taught me to be a part of a home group. He taught me to be accountable to meetings. I can tell you that every Wednesday and every Sunday at 8 o'clock, I know exactly where he's going to be if he's in town. He taught me to work with other alcoholics. At any given time, he may have, you know, anywhere from 3 to 10 people that he's working with. And he's taught me a lot of these things and to just be a part of the fellowship. And someone else was nice enough to show me the triangle, the AA triangle, and the three parts of that. You know, unity, recovery, and service. And it was ingrained in me early on to recognize that I need to be a part of the fellowship. I need to be a part of doing service work. I met Billy in Southern Pines for the first time, you know, at a corrections workshop down there. For the longest time, I took meetings into the jail until they told me that I couldn't come back because I broke a rule. You know, I gave somebody a stick of gum, and, you know, we want to talk about resentment. You know, here I am going to the jail. I'm being a martyr here. You know, you should appreciate me. You know, and all that. You know, that just takes you right back to step one. You know, the alcohol is not necessarily the problem right now, but the second part of that is my life is still unmanageable in so many different ways, and I have to continue to take inventory, and when I'm wrong, promptly admit it. And so, you know, I had to swallow my pride and, you know, admit, hey, I need to stop going to the jail for a while. And, you know, but there are a lot of other ways that to carry the message. Again, you know, I've had the great opportunity to work with alcoholics. God, can you have favorite sponsees? My favorite sponsee came into the program while in college, and he just recently graduated from UVA with a doctorate degree. He just moved a week ago to Boston to start a new career and a new life up there, and he was absolutely he's everything that I want to be. You know, he is carrying the message. He'll call me up and he'll say, you know, hey, I went to this meeting and I have a resentment. And, you know, but this is what I'm doing about it. You know, I've asked God to remove it. I've talked to you about it, you know, and I'm going to go wash the dishes for my girlfriend. You know, that kind of thing. And it's like, wow, I'm watching this work. And it's like, holy crap, it does work. You know, and I'd always heard that you always tell sponsees to do things that, you know, just to test the waters to make sure it was okay. And then if it worked, then you could do it, you know. So I did that with him. And he, you know, things like, you know, you should probably make coffee there. And so he became such a service-oriented person. And it was just, it's just awesome to see that, you know, service work is so important in keeping people sober. It works for me. You know, this program is a program for living, and I'd like to say that life has just been great since I got sober, and parts of it have been. You know, I work for a company that I'm really glad to be a part of. I've been there for 5 years. That's the longest I've ever been with a company ever, unless I was forced to stay there by a contract with like the military, And it was funny because at about year two, I know that I had been saying it a lot, but I would tell somebody and say, you know, I really enjoy working here. I'm really grateful to have this job. I appreciate it. And one day he said, you know, did it ever occur to you that we enjoy having you here? You know, that we like having you here? And it was like total new concept to me because I still today think that, you know, next week could be my last day, you know, because they're going to figure out that I'm not qualified, or it's typical. I mean, it's just how I feel. And I have to go back and I have to work steps on it. And I have to understand that God is going to take care of me. God is going to take care of me, and I believe that. I have someone that I work with, and she's intimidating. And it's not so much because I think that she has more power than me. I think that she has the power to, if she wanted to get me fired. And so when I think about that, you know, and I didn't realize it until one day I had said something bad about her to one of my coworkers, and then I thought about it for a second, and I was like, it's because she has so much power. And then the word power clicked, and I'm like, but there's one who has all power. That one is God. And if I really believe in God, and God has worked for me in my life, and has worked for me in my sobriety, why doesn't God work for me in this situation? You know. And if I really believe that, then I know that whether she gets me fired or I get myself fired, God's going to take care of me. That if I suit up, I show up, and I do my part, God is going to take care of me. And if I keep my fingers off of it and I just do what I'm supposed to do, God is going to take care of me. You know, and I've had some things happen in sobriety. My mom has Alzheimer's, and her husband of 18 years, who was younger than her, decided that he didn't want to be bothered with it, and so he divorced her. And in the process of that, my mom came to live with me. Her husband had access, I guess, to the place where her furniture and stuff was stored, and that furniture got shipped to my house. And halfway across the country, the person in the vehicle said, "You know, all this furniture is damaged." And I'm like, "I don't know what you're talking about." And he said, "Somebody has damaged all of it." And when we got it, you know, and inspected it, you know, somebody had taken a key or a screwdriver and had just marred up every last piece of furniture. And you know, the truth is there are some sick people in this world, you know, and at least as alcoholics, you know, we get exposed to see what our spiritual disease. Some people don't have that. Some people don't get it. Some people don't see it. And, you know, I have people say, man, I would be really angry. And I can't be angry at this. I can't be angry at him because he is far sicker than I think I've ever been. And I have a solution, you know, for what ails me today. I have a solution that I can count on that continues to work and continues to work. And I feel sorry for him. You know, I don't. And people say, you still have to be angry. And I'm like, no, I really am not angry at this person. I just can't be angry at them because what does it take for someone to, you know, damage all this stuff from of a woman who has a disease that she has no control over. And I tried to, you know, my mom lived with me for a couple of years before things just got really, really hard, and she became a wanderer. And eventually she had to go into an assisted living, and she's in a nursing home in Charlottesville. And I still visit her, even though she doesn't know who I am. She doesn't know my name. And people want to say, well, God, that must piss you off too. And I'm like, you know, I didn't cause it. And, you know, and I don't know why it's there, but, you know, it's not for me to understand. You know, I still have, she's still my mom, and I still want to, you know, try to see her and to, you know, just try to give some positive feedback, you know, positive energy her way. My dad and I, we didn't speak for years. When I was a year in sobriety, my brother called me and said, you know, Dad's going to have some heart surgery and he might not make it. And I said, well, I hope he makes it, but, you know, I don't really have anything to say to him. And my dad had 5 bypasses and you know, lived to tell about it. And 1 year, it was probably after the first year of sobriety, I was looking for Christmas cards, and I found one with a St. Thomas prayer on it. And I thought, well, this is an awesome card. You know, it's perfect. You know, where there is love or where there is hate, you know the prayer. And so I sent Christmas cards, and I sent my dad one. And I don't know why. Part of it was because he's an alcoholic. And you know what? He doesn't know what sobriety is. He doesn't know a solution to things like his fear and his anxiety and his anger. And he has a lot of those things, or he had a lot of those things. And if people are going to be nice enough to forgive me for a lot of the crap that I've done, how can I not do the same? And it wasn't a great relationship, but, you know, I could tell him that I loved him, and I could tell him that, you know, I wanted him to come and visit me. This other thing happened was that, you know, in sobriety, you know, early on, I got this bill from the government saying, hey, by the way, you owe us about $18,000 in debt, you know, for student loans that you didn't pay. And I'm like, well, gosh, somebody said, well, where did you think they went? I'm like, well, I don't know. I mean, I know at some point they were garnishing my wage, you know. And I'm like, but it's my debt, you know. And I'm just going to write the check. And so every month I wrote the check. You know, I had the money come straight from my account and be deposited in theirs. And so I did this. And so this amazing thing happens when you pay your bills on time is you get good credit. And after having worked in the mortgage business, and again, I almost tear up when I talk about this because, you know, when I was in the mortgage business, I didn't have a credit score. You know, I was writing loans for people who had, you know, 700, you know, 750s, and I was just like, oh, wow, this is, and I'll never have this. I'll never have a house. I'll never own anything. And it turns out that if you pay your bills on time, they actually give you credit, and if you're responsible with your credit, then your credit score goes up. And a friend of mine who's in the mortgage business still checked my credit once, and he's like, oh, wow, you have a great credit score. You know, it's like right around 700. And, I mean, I literally almost cried because that's one of those things that I never thought that, you know, he's like, you can buy a house. I'm like, holy cow. So I ended up buying a house, and my experience in the Navy gave me a good loan and a good rate, and, you know, I'm telling you these things not because I work for these things, but these are gifts. These are things that happen because I changed who I was, because I've become a different person. You know, because I'm responsible. You know, I didn't set out to go and buy a house. It happened because I was responsible, because I paid my bills on time. You know, my mother came to live with me, and because I was responsible. You know, that's the only thing. And so I have, and I have this great job, and it's not because I deserve it. It's just because I'm responsible today. You know, I suit up and I show up and I do my part. And that's what AA has always taught me. And part of me telling that was, I had something there that I was going to say. I went back. I worked the steps with other alcoholics. You know, I used to make the suggestions, do the 90 meetings, 90 days. Call me on a regular basis. I tell people, you know, call me every day, you know, for at least a month, and then we'll talk about it after that. And so, in working the steps with somebody, I went and I pulled out my original four step, and in my fear list, the first fear on there was that my mom would die without ever knowing how much I really loved her. You know, and that was pretty cool because I don't think that's an issue anymore. You know, one of the things that I put on there was that I would never own a house. You know, and that's taken care of. You know, it's not actually mine, but you know, but the thing is that I didn't set out to have these things happen. They just happened because of AA. These are all gifts. You know, my home group is on Friday nights at 8 o'clock at Hinton Avenue Methodist Church. It's called the Belmont Heights Group. It's an awesome meeting. We have a great fellowship. We have the meeting before the meeting, and often we have the meeting after the meeting, and that's where, you know, I work on a lot of my issues. But when I'm in a meeting, it's because, you know what, I have a good life today, and I owe my good life to AA. I owe it to working the steps. I owe it to suiting up and showing up and being a part of a home group and being a part of carrying the message to alcoholics, whether it's to the jail or, you know, in a meeting. I think it's my responsibility. I think it's my responsibility. When I go to an AA meeting and I hear people, you know, pardon this is me judging again. You know, when I sit here, people whining about, you know, my boss yelled at me, you know, or this happened, and I have to be in check with those things. But I have to remember that at some point I was a lot like that, and I'm not like that now because I have a solution. I have a solution to those things. The solution is that it's in the 12 steps. It's in trusting, finding a higher power, trusting in God, putting your faith in there, and you know, I have, it's funny because one of the people that lives with me is here, and I think about that all the time. I'm like, God, he gets to see the real me. You know, you guys see that, you know, the polished version, and he gets to see the, you know, the wreck. I'll be the first to tell you though that, you know, I'm not perfect by any stretch. It doesn't say anywhere you have to be perfect. It says progress. And so I like to think that I'm still working on trying to be a better person and to not be the person that I have been. Unfortunately, sometimes it requires pain. You know, I'm a firm believer that, you know, it's not always, we don't always grow because we see the light. It's usually because we feel the heat. And unfortunately, that's the way a lot of my growth happens these days. But I'm just really, really grateful for AA. I'm grateful for having a solution, and I try to get that across to newcomers. It's like, you know, alcohol has always been a solution. Alcohol is a solution for your uncomfortability. You know, it's that fear of not fitting in. You know, not doing well. You know, thinking that people are judging you. Alcohol was always a solution for those feelings, and I still have a lot of those feelings today. But I don't. AA has given me another solution. That solution is AA and working the steps. And I could just repeat that over and over and over and over again. So I'm just really grateful. Thanks for letting me speak. And y'all come to our group sometime too. All right.